recognize that jump rope song? Well, most people do. But what do you really know about the trial of Lizzie Borden? Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. And we're going to talk to the author of a new book on Borden. She is Kara Robertson, and she's a lawyer and author. And Kara was educated at Harvard, Oxford, and Stanford Law School. And she's a former Supreme Court law clerk. Her book is called The Trial of Lizzie Borden, A True Story. What are your impressions of this famous case, and why do you think we still remember it? We'd like to hear from you, so give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Kara, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
Now, you started researching Lizzie Borden as a senior at Harvard. You published your first paper on the trial. When did you actually first come to know the case?
I suppose I had heard about the rhyme as a kid,
yeah.
and I know that my parents had a book on great public trials, and I remember reading about the case then.
Okay.
So it must have been in the back of my mind when it came time to pick a senior thesis topic.
Now, did you think that kind of started you thinking about the law as a career choice, or was it something else?
It probably helped, though I have to say it was a little bit of the family business.
Okay. That always helps, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, what aspect of the case did you write about in your paper?
Well, I was interested in the way in which you could use a trial as a window onto a period in American history. And I was attracted to the Gilded Age, the late 19th century in America, a time of great turmoil, a time that, you know, has a lot of resonance for today, actually.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of discussions about immigration, and the role of women in society.
And so I'm assuming then that you just use that as a jumping off point for your book, because you do follow those same kind of themes in it.
That's right. That's right. It my interest expanded, and I wanted to follow the case from the beginning to the end, basically.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote your paper in 97. What took you so long?
a question my parents often ask me.
Yeah.
Well, partly I was doing other things, including clerking, as you mentioned, and working at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia in The Hague. Partly I just went down a lot of research rabbit holes, and found myself really intrigued by so many of the interesting characters around the case, as well as the essential mystery of the story.
Sure. And before we go too far with that, let's just go over the basic facts of the case. Where and when did it occur?
Sure. On the morning of August 4th in 1892, the prosperous mill town of Fall River, Massachusetts, was the site of this particularly grisly double murder. Andrew Borden, who was a prominent local businessman, and his second wife, Abby, were found hacked to death in their home that was near the city center. As I mentioned, Fall River, Massachusetts, was a mill town. It was a center for textile production in the United States. It was called the Manchester of America. It produced so much cotton.
Mm-hmm. And who were some of the main characters involved? And there were lots of characters, and I was thankful for the end of your book. You do have a list of them. But who were some of the main characters involved?
Sure. Well, they're the victims, Andrew Borden and his wife, Abby. Andrew Borden's two daughters, Emma, who was out of town at the time of the murders, and his younger daughter, Lizzie, who was a 32-year-old unmarried woman living at home. There was also a brother-in-law who was visiting named John Morse. And then, you know, as the case moves on, it involves many of the immediate neighbors and friends of the family, probably the most prominent lawyers in Massachusetts at the time, including the former governor, and a lot of bold-faced names from journalism, people we might recognize as columnists and personalities today.
Sure. We're talking to Kara Robertson. She's a lawyer and author, and her book is called The Trial of Lizzie Borden, A True Story. If you have any questions about the Borden case or about researching something like this, give us a call. Join in the conversation, 1-800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always send us an email. And that email address is ideas@wpr.org. Now, how was the Borden family perceived in Fall River?
Well, Mr. Borden was a descendant of one of the founding families, and it was the sort of place and time where the elite were mostly mill owners who were descended in one way or another from those original families. He was from a part of the line that had been less successful and was himself really a self-made man. Who earned his wealth from real estate. He was, however, known to be a bit of a miser. A local journalist described him as someone who was a lot more interested in piling up dollars than in spending them. And this was thought to be a source of some dissatisfaction in the household.
Yeah, and that was interesting to me because I had, you know, of course, I've heard about the case and whatnot, but I've never really gone into such detail. Now, the stepmother, Abby, who we probably don't hear about too much when we hear about the case, she'd actually been the stepmother for the two Borden girls for quite a few years, wasn't she?
Yes, actually, Lizzie Borden would not have known her own biological mm-hmm. mother at all. Mm-hmm. So Abby was really the woman that had raised her.
And what was the relationship like in the house? What did you find when you were doing the research?
Well, it emerged that that it was the site of what you know we might think of as kind of a Cold War. Mm-hmm. Housemaid Bridget Sullivan served two different sittings for dinner because the daughters really didn't want to eat with their stepmother and father, and they conducted their lives as separately as possible. I mean, in proper Yankee fashion, they perhaps didn't talk very much, but they always responded to a direct question. But other than that, it was frosty.
It sounds like an interesting household. What was it at the scene that caused the authorities to think that Lizzie was the one who had done the crime?
Well, you know, because of the brutality of the crimes, they imagined that it would have been the work of a madman who just wandered in. But there were two things that seemed to rule that out. The first, the house seemed like it had been locked. There was a side door that in theory could have permitted someone to come in, but that seemed fairly unlikely. And more than that, it was discovered that the two victims were killed about an hour and a half or 2 hours apart, which really seemed to rule out an outside murderer, especially since there were two women known to be in the house at the time who would have been, you know, other victims had it been just a crazed maniac who'd come in.
Right. And what did Lizzie, what was her explanation of what had happened?
Yeah, Lizzie discovered her father's body on the sitting room sofa and alerted the housekeeper and sent her for a doctor. At some point, a little bit later in the morning, she volunteered that she thought her stepmother had returned home. And sent a neighbor and the housemaid up to go look for her where they discovered her body. She gave pretty inconsistent accounts of where she was at the time of both murders, and that was part of what attracted attention, mm-hmm. Attracted the attention of the police.
Were there ever any other suspects?
Well, over the years, everyone has been a suspect.
Of course. at the time, were there any others?
Right. Bridget Sullivan, the Irish housemaid whose ethnicity, you know, would have made her a more likely suspect than Lizzie Borden, according to prevailing criminological theories, fortunately had an alibi. She was washing windows outside at the time that Mrs. Borden was killed. And then the only other suspect in the short term was John Morse, the brother-in-law, whose visit seemed to mysteriously coincide with the murders. Mm-hmm. But he had left early in the morning, and at the time of the murders was riding on a horse car to see other relatives in a car that was shared by six priests. So, and when he had an alibi sort of out of an Agatha Christie novel.
Definitely, definitely. And it really surprised me when you started talking about how many people, and not necessarily authorities, were traipsing around in that murder scene right after it happened. Was that the way it normally would have worked?
Yeah, I think it's pretty shocking for the for the modern reader or the modern viewer of, mm-hmm. of any crime show,
right.
how unsecure the scene was. The house was on what you might call a mixed use, partly residential, partly commercial street.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a fair amount of foot traffic, and it did seem that once word of the murder spread that, you know, anybody who was even tangentially associated with the Bordens came by to take a look.
Right. And there were kids, and there were just people that happened to be by the street were called in. And yeah, I could see where it would be a little bit confusing when those evidence was placed in the trial. What were some of the things that they actually were able to use scientific evidence in the trial at that point?
Well, the most important scientific evidence that they had was the times of death of the two victims were different, so that they were able to show as a result of blood coagulation, temperature, and digestion, that Mr. Borden had been killed about an hour and a half to 2 hours after his wife, Mrs. Borden.
Mm-hmm.
And that was significant in terms of establishing what the prosecution saw as Lizzie Borden's exclusive opportunity. There was also a lot of discussion of a possible murder weapon and whether or not a handleless hatchet, in other words, a hatchet whose handle had been broken off, was the murder weapon or not. And that involved, you know, measuring wounds and the like.
Right.
Some of the most important evidence for the prosecution was not admitted, namely that a woman who was identified as Lizzie Borden tried to buy poison the day before the murders and was refused.
Okay. And we've got a couple of minutes just before we take a short break for news. But before that, why don't you tell us a little bit about the lawyers on either side of this case? Who were they? And what was their reputations?
The main prosecutor was a man named Jose Knowlton, who was extremely highly regarded and would go on to be the Attorney General of Massachusetts. His junior partner had an even more distinguished career. He went on to be Attorney General of the U.S., Secretary of the Navy in the Teddy Roosevelt administration, and he sat on the Supreme Court. And the defense lawyers were pretty much the best that Lizzie Borden's considerable inheritance could buy. In addition to the Borden's family lawyer, Andrew Jennings, there was a trial lawyer named Melvin Adams from Boston, who was a bit of a dandy, but he handled all of the scientific and medical evidence. And then the star of the team was the former governor of Massachusetts, George Robinson.
Not to be confused with your last name, which is Robertson, so no relation, right?
Yes, no relation.
No relation. Why did they decide to take this case? Why did he in particular?
Well, he did earn a $25,000 fee, which was pretty good.
Yes, it was.
But it was a cause celeb. It was probably, you know, the equivalent of the O.J. Simpson trial.
If you think about
the amount of attention given
sure.
the case.
And we'll look into that in a little bit. But right now we're going to take a little short break and get some news. And then we'll be right back to talk to Kara Robertson about the Lizzie Borden trial. Well, we all like a whodunit, and a real-life whodunit is even more intriguing. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking with Kara Robertson. She's the author of a new book called The Trial of Lizzie Borden, A True Story. Now, Kara holds a PhD in English from Oxford University and a law degree from Stanford. She is clerk for the Supreme Court and has served as a legal advisor to the International Criminal Tribunal at The Hague. What questions do you have about the Lizzie Borden case? What would you like to know about how the research was done for the book? Join in the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, Kara, why don't you talk a little bit about how you've set up this book? Because I thought it was very useful in learning more about it.
I decided that the story should be told chronologically, you know, beginning with the attempt to buy prussic acid, and then following the case through its conclusion and on to the curious afterlife of
the
story.
Yes. Yeah, and I just thought it was so so nice that it was set up that way, because we've heard so much, and you know, about a little bit here, a little bit there. So this was nice to have it chronologically. Now let's go to the trial, because that is the main portion of your book. It's the trial. What was it like physically to be in that courtroom?
It was a relatively small courtroom that had to be refashioned to accommodate all of the press that wanted to attend. It was, you know, many reported that it was the biggest collection and most impressive collection of newspaper correspondents, illustrators, and stringers ever detailed to cover a trial. At the same time, there were many people who wanted to attend. Just as members of the audience. And so police had to set up a barricade. And one reporter described the courthouse as packed as only a clever stevedore could pack it.
And you had mentioned earlier about the O.J. Simpson, and I could not help but compare the two when I was reading this. What are some of the similarities between, you know, the case that we've had in the last few years and that case?
Well, I think it was the sense that it was important nationally. You know, that this was a story that generated headlines, at least initially, because it was such a terrible crime. But when it became clear that the main suspect was the daughter of the victims, then the whole story seemed quite dark and of national and even international significance. And in particular, it is the identity of the accused, the fact that she ticks all the boxes of proper, respectable, middle-class femininity, someone who is active in her local church, was a Sunday school teacher, the idea that she could have been capable of such brutality seemed like a threat to the social order.
And those, you said it was packed, that courtroom. It didn't take place in Fall River. It took place in a nearby town, right?
Right. It took place in New Bedford, which is famous for its whaling history. And the idea was that tensions were too high in Fall River to hold the trial there, and none of the jurors were from Fall River either, on the assumption that it would be too difficult to find people who didn't already have a strong opinion.
And it must have been hard to find anybody in the nation that didn't at that point, right?
Right. Well, there were many people who knew about the case. They actually assumed that the jury selection would take a long time. But in fact, it was concluded in a day, though it was noted that it seemed to be slightly older men.
Mm-hmm.
There was the kind of research done on prospective jurors that you would expect to see today and be surprised to see in the late 19th century. The prosecution had a file on every prospective juror, and particularly noted men who were heads of households and who might have had a second wife.
So they wanted to be able, and daughters, right? Wasn't that another criteria?
That's right. There did seem to be a preference for men with daughters about Lizzie Borden's age.
And at that time, women were not allowed to be jurors.
That's right. There were no women on a jury in Massachusetts until 1951.
In the press, and as you had mentioned, the press were all over this story. How was Lizzie treated?
It depended on the newspaper and in that the local newspapers were pretty much split along class and ethnic lines. The Irish Catholic paper was effectively Lizzie Borden's journalistic nemesis throughout the case, and referred to her as a human sphinx, as a sphinx of coolness.
Mm-hmm.
But other newspapers saw her remarkable composure in a different light. They saw it as more the sort of dignity you might expect in the of a lady who's accused of something that she did not do.
Now, what was the basic argument on either side of this case?
The basic argument for the prosecution is that really no one else could have done it, that only Lizzie Borden had the opportunity to do it, and that she alone had the motive to kill her stepmother. And the stepmother is viewed as the central victim in the sense that she is the reason for the murders. Mr. Borden is viewed as the much more important victim. In fact, the stepmother's murder was only added to the charges after the original indictment. But the defense manages to seize on this central problem, which is that the prosecution can really only argue that whoever killed Mrs. Borden also killed Mr. Borden, because they don't want to argue that Lizzie Borden really, really intended to kill her father, rather that it was a kind of dreadful necessity when she was caught in the house without the ability to get out and establish an alibi.
Because her father did come home unexpectedly, right?
Right. So her stepmother was killed in an upstairs guest room about 9:30 in the morning while Mr. Borden was out. He returned about 10:45, so at that point, the prosecution argues that Lizzie Borden had to amend her plan and decided to kill him too because she couldn't face his knowing that she'd killed the stepmother.
Right. And you had mentioned earlier about some setbacks for the prosecution. One of them was the poison. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, you can imagine that was really important in that it showed intent. You know, it suggested that there really might have been this plan to kill as opposed to some sort of sudden impulse. And it also explained why someone like Lizzie Borden, who benefited from late 19th century conceptions of what proper women were capable of, why someone like her would have picked up what was seen as a male weapon, an axe or a hatchet. If she had tried to buy poison, the supremely woman's weapon, the feminine weapon of choice, and failed, then she might have, in desperation, turned to a readily available household implement.
Right, and to kind of go over that, she was seen, and there are two witnesses or so, asking for this acid, and she said she wanted to use it to clean a seal cape, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. So there were three people at a local pharmacist who identified her as a woman who asked for prussic acid, which is a dilution of hydrocyanic acid, and it's only sold on a doctor's prescription. And oddly, this woman had said that she wanted it to clean a sealskin cape. And keep in mind, this was August.
Right.
And no such use had ever been heard of. Yeah.
Yes. And now, why wasn't that information given to the jury?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. The defense was able to successfully argue that you couldn't show that it didn't have innocent uses. You know, in other words, that it might well be something that one would have around the household for some reason other than murder, because there were many other poisons in mm-hmm. common use mm-hmm. in households. And so the idea then would be that it was totally inflammatory because it had nothing directly to do with the murder of people by a hatchet. It's not clear that that really should have been a persuasive argument, but it worked.
Yeah, I was kind of, that was a very questionable argument. Now, the other one that was not, the jury did not get the inquest information from Lizzie, correct?
Right, and the inquest is the only time that Lizzie Borden testified under oath, so it memorialized her shifting stories about where she was at the time of each of the murders. And it also provided ample evidence directly from her own lips about the discord in the household. So it was something that the prosecution really wanted to get in before the jury. But the defense, again, was able to make a successful argument, and an argument that, you know, one has to think was really informed by late 19th century ideas about gender. Their technical argument was that Lizzie Borden had not been cautioned. Now, keep in mind, this was many years before Miranda.
Oh yes.
But there was a rule in Massachusetts that once someone was arrested, that they had to receive some kind of formal caution, and that although Lizzie Borden actually did consult with her lawyer, she was refused legal counsel during the inquest. Her lawyer was not allowed to attend it with her. And that was totally normal procedure, as the prosecution pointed out. But the defense was able to make that seem like she had been really bullied by a whole set of official men who were trying to extort something from her that they could later use at trial. And the judges were sympathetic to that argument.
We're talking with Kara Robertson. She's a lawyer and author, and her book is called The Trial of Lizzie Borden, A True Story. Who do you think did it? Do you think Lizzie was guilty? Do you think that someone else did it? Give us a call. We'd like to hear what you have to say, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can always send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, Carrie, you had just mentioned that you said judges, and that was a little different. I was surprised that there were three judges for this trial rather than one. Why was that?
There was a rule in Massachusetts that for capital cases, there had to be three judges. So there was a panel with a chief judge and two associate judges.
We talked about the setbacks, but what were some of the other reasons that you think that the prosecution lost this case? And I don't think I'm giving anything away by telling you that she was acquitted.
Right. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Don't listen.
Well, the defense was really good about trying to remind the jury that, you know, that really wasn't their job to solve the mystery, that there were strange men who were seen in the vicinity, even though they couldn't actually place them inside the house. And they also questioned whether or not a woman really could have physically committed such brutal murders, even though all of the medical experts testified that a woman of ordinary strength could have done so. And then they did a good job of emphasizing the missteps in the police investigation to suggest some kind of orchestrated conspiracy to pin the murders on Lizzie Borden, that the police were just desperate to get a solution, and so picked the suspect that was at hand. And they were helped by police witnesses that contradicted each other about the possible murder weapon, about the discovery of the possible murder weapon, which was this handleless hatchet found in the basement.
Right, we hadn't talked about that. That was pretty much it's pretty much thought that is the murder weapon.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That seems to have been the murder weapon in that it could have made all the wounds, and it was on the scene. And it seemed unlikely that anyone would have been able to remove such a weapon. The police said that the handle had been broken off in a way that wasn't really consistent with an accidental break.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument that they're making in that presentation is that that was done so that the hatchet head itself could be more easily cleaned, and then that the hatchet head was covered with this some kind of adhesion of ash from the basement, and then placed in a box of disused tools, so that it, you know, it was almost like it was an attempt at subterfuge, you know, an attempt to hide it.
Sure. Well, we do have a couple of calls, so let's take those. Our first caller is Tom, and he's in Mequon. Hi, Tom. What's your question?
Well, I've heard it said today, and I've heard in the past also, that the two murders took place several hours apart. And I'm just wondering how that is known with the forensic evidence of the day.
Kara?
Oh, yes. So they were able to determine that by the temperature of the bodies, the level of blood coagulation, the description of the witnesses at the time, and then thirdly by the state of the digestion, because we know that Mr. and Mrs. Borden ate breakfast around the same time. And so in one case, the food had been, you know, more thoroughly digested than in the other case. But as you point out, this was something that the defense liked to chip away at to try to make the murders as close together as possible, which would make it more likely that it was an outside suspect.
And they did that in a lot of different ways, didn't they?
Yes, they were very good at their cross-examination of the witnesses. And the coroner had not kept the sort of records you might expect. So that also benefited the defense.
Okay, and we've got another call from Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I read a book some years ago about this trial, and that author claimed that there had been a homosexual relationship between Lizzie and the maid, whose name was Bridget, and that the stepmother caught them in some kind of sexual activity, and that's why she was killed, because evidently the stepmother would be saying, well, I'm going to tell your father about this, and so that's why she was killed. So I'm wondering if that enters into your book at all, and I'm very anxious to read this, because this whole episode of this particular murder has always intrigued me.
Kara?
Yes, well, It speaks to the absence of a romance in the story, that pretty much everyone seems to wish there was a better motive than the sort of suffocating tension and a general desire for financial independence. There's really no evidence that there was any kind of relationship between Lizzie and Bridget, and you know, we're confident that Bridget was out of the house at the time. So I think, you know, again, that says more about what our desires are than what, you know, might have actually happened.
Thank you, Nancy, for bringing that up. There have been a number of movies and television shows and certainly a lot of books. What are your feelings towards those different interpretations?
I usually enjoy them. You know, I'm struck by the way that, you know, every generation seems to get its own Lizzie.
Yes.
You know, in the sense that, you know, partly we just look at the case from our own moment in time. It's obviously easy in retrospect to see the blindnesses or preoccupations of other eras. But, you know, it's hard to avoid our own. And I think that those interpretations, you know, tell us more about the anxieties of the chroniclers than, you know, any essential truth about the mystery.
Very true. So they're good for entertainment, but not necessarily for the actual case.
Right. They almost always have to be fictionalized. Again, the thing that's probably most popular is to find a romantic interest.
Sure. Now, without telling us if you think Lizzie is guilty or not, and that's your opinion, obviously, you can tell us if you want, but has it changed over the years with all the evidence that you've looked at?
Yeah, well, I found that in trying to lay out the story as fairly as possible and as close to the primary sources as possible, that, you know, my views would shift over time.
Mm.
where I think, like, well, how on earth could she not have been covered with blood if, how on earth could she have been presented herself free of blood twice if she did do it, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that I pretty much have ended up where I started, which is that it's very difficult as a practical matter to imagine how she actually could have done it. But it's almost impossible to think that anyone else could have done so.
Right. And we're just about out of time, Karen. This is such an interesting topic. But we did have Cindy call in and say, what happened to Lizzie after she was acquitted? So briefly, can you kind of tell us what she did in her life?
Sure. After the trial, Lizzie went home to some acclaim in Fall River, although there were many people, particularly among the Irish Catholic population and the working classes, that thought she'd gotten away with murder. So it started out as the life that she might have always wanted. She moved to a grander house in the elite residential district of Fall River, attended the World's Fair in Chicago, and was an independently wealthy woman. But shortly after her acquittal, she was frozen out of her church, the same church whose spiritual leaders had provided the bedrock of her support during the trial. And that pretty much set the tone for her treatment in the polite circles of the town. So that she chose to stay in Fall River, but she was shunned by the people she had most wished to know rather than live out her life in anonymity elsewhere.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kar, so much for sharing this with us. And for those who are listening, please really read the book. It's called The Trial of Lizzie Borden, A True Story. You will really enjoy it. Hope you can join us tomorrow when appraiser Shirley Bauman will be back with us to talk about antiquities and collectibles. I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network.